Without further ado, we can get started. So we're here, obviously, to talk about crisis and U.S. imperialism, Venezuela today. Our speaker is Ben Fowler from Perth, he'll speak for about however long he wants, and then there'll be time for questions and discussion afterwards. So take it away, Ben.
So, as you will all already know, earlier this year, Venezuela was plunged into an unprecedented political crisis by Juan Guaido, the Speaker of Venezuela's National Assembly, its parliament. So, he unilaterally declared himself interim president of Venezuela, and this was effectively a challenge to the institutional legitimacy of Nicolás Maduro, Venezuela's recently re-elected president. And this challenge to Maduro's legitimacy was accompanied by a large-scale campaign, very clearly supported by the United States, Trump's United States, aimed at toppling the government of Venezuela. And so while the coup attempt now seems to have failed, at least for the time being, it has nonetheless set the tone for a new, more combative era in Venezuelan and Latin American politics. And we have to kind of come to grips with this new, more combative era. This crisis has not sprung out of nowhere, but is the culmination of a two-decade-long struggle for control of the Venezuelan state between a right-wing opposition aligned with the United States and traditional business interests, and a new political order developed under the left-wing presidency of Hugo Chavez. And I think this struggle can only really be understood within the prism of Latin American neoliberalism and its response in the pink tide, a wave of left-wing governments that arose out of popular discontent with the established political and economic order throughout Latin America in the past 20 years. So for a decade and a half, these various left-wing governments have dominated the political direction of Latin America, and Venezuela, which has always been the kind of crown jewel of the pink tide, was where you saw some of the most radical kind of developments of any of the countries that were involved in the pink tide. And so with this kind of wave of right-wing electoral victories across Latin America, the most recent being that of fascist Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Venezuela's government is now one of the last remaining pink tide regimes standing. And it's besieged from within and without by virulent right-wing opponents. And so to understand how we got here, we have to go back to Venezuela's own particular history of neoliberalism and its pink tide response. And that was all crystallized around the presidency of Hugo Chavez. So before Chavez was elected Venezuelan president in 1998, Venezuela had for 40 years been governed by a consensual power-sharing agreement between the country's two major capitalist parties, Democratic Action, Acción Democrática, a traditional centre-left social democratic party, and the Social Christian Party, also known as COPE, a party of traditional centre-right conservatives. And so this consensual power-sharing agreement, called the Punto Fijo Pact, was ostensibly meant to preserve Venezuelan democracy after a period of dictatorship in the 50s and 60s. But in practice, it created an extremely rigid two-party system. They excluded and violently repressed all other political forces, particularly the left. And so during this period, the two parties were fervent supporters of the drive towards neoliberalism, accumulating sizable amounts of debt owed to the IMF and the World Bank, and implementing intense austerity measures whenever there was a drop in the price of oil, Venezuela's primary export commodity. Now I'll go more into the influence of oil on the Venezuelan economy later. So this situation came to a head in 1989, when in response to a new wave of IMF-mandated austerity implemented by the Venezuelan government, workers in Caracas, Venezuela's capital, marched out to engage in mass protests and rioting. And these mass protests, as so often happens in Latin America, crystallized around an increase in the price of public transport. So the government doubled the price of tickets for public transport, and workers just took it upon themselves kind of to basically burn all of the buses. So this uprising on the streets often just full-blown rioting would come to be known as the Caracazo. And though it was ended via intense repression and violence in only 9 days, it effectively spelled the political doom of neoliberalism in Venezuela and the unraveling of the political order that had governed the country for decades. So when I talk about repression, it was quite serious repression, as in, you know, as much as 3,000 people were murdered, and they're still trying to account for all the disappeared to this day. And so it's from this, the Caracazo, and the social and political forces that emerged from it, it's from this uprising that Hugo Chavez would go on to become president in 1998. So Chavez himself, an officer in the Venezuelan military, became a household name when he and fellow members of a group called the Revolutionary Bolivarian Movement, which is essentially a left-wing study group of soldiers, which then turned into a kind of band of conspirators inside the military, attempted to mount a coup in 1992 off the back of the discontent created by the Caracazo. While they were defeated by loyal elements of the military, Chavez's brief appearance on national television after his arrest, in which he claimed to be the voice of the Caracazo, made him extremely popular amongst the Venezuelan working class. And this is where you get this famous interview with him as he's being arrested, where he says, we'll be back. And so 2 years later, when Chavez and the other conspirators of the coup were released from prison, he became a political focal point for the growing opposition to Venezuelan neoliberalism. And so moving away from a strategy of insurrection, Chavez formed his own political party, the Fifth Republic Movement, in order to contest the 1998 election. And so his politics at the time, and those of the forces around him, were nationalist, in that they wanted to see a change of in Venezuela's relationship in regards to the United States, and reformist, in that they wanted to see a more equitable distribution of the wealth created by the Venezuelan oil industry. And there was not at this time any kind of sense that the Chavista program was socialist or revolutionary in character in any kind of sense. So despite these kind of they weren't particularly radical, these politics. Despite that, it's worth saying that from the get-go, Chavez's program and plans for Venezuela were more radical and transformative than those of virtually any other force falling under the umbrella of the Pink Tide. While more conservative forces, like the Workers' Party in Brazil, which Mick will talk about in the session tomorrow, forces like the Workers' Party committed themselves from the get-go to respecting constitutionality and the status quo way before they even got into government, Chavez was always committed to reconfiguration of Venezuela's political institutions on a more democratic basis. So when he was elected president in 1998, with the backing of a broad coalition of left-wing parties, including the Venezuelan Communist Party, Chavez ultimately immediately set about establishing a constituent assembly to write a new Venezuelan constitution. And so this kind of constituent assembly idea can seem a bit kind of abstract and kind of foreign to socialists in the West, so it's worth kind of going into a little bit. So the constituent assembly essentially functioned as a kind of supreme parliament, elected via universal suffrage and able to override the will of all other state institutions, like the established parliament and the courts. So after calling and then winning a referendum to convene a constituent assembly, the broad left forces centred around Chavez then won elections for the body and used it to draft a new Venezuelan constitution. It's also worth mentioning that referendums of any sort were actually completely unheard of in Venezuela, had never happened before, and were also extremely rare throughout Latin America. The only other close example I can think of is the Chilean referendum on the dictatorship, which was extremely rare. And so a 6-month period of political debate accompanied the Constituent Assembly, and it kind of raised the aspirations and expectations of ordinary people who had never kind of had any real stake in the Venezuelan political process, and gained Chavez a very kind of mass popular following. And so while the new constitution that they drafted in the Constituent Assembly was in no way a break from Venezuelan capitalism, it was radically democratic, particularly when you consider that every other Latin American country at the time was governed by constitutions that were drafted during the military dictatorships in the 70s and 80s. And so the new constitution dissolved the undemocratic and aristocratic Venezuelan Senate. It ended military conscription and gave soldiers the right to vote. It recognized indigenous languages and set out a charter of indigenous and environmental rights and set up a revocation referendum system by which voters could initiate a referendum to remove any government official, including the president, for a petition signed by more than 20% of those on the electoral roll. So this essentially meant that a sizable section of the Venezuelan electorate could challenge the legitimacy of publicly elected officials, which is more democratic than anything we have here in Australia, at least. And this new constitution was approved in a second referendum with over 70% of the vote, so it was massively popular. And so already much of this was well beyond the pale for Venezuelan elites and the traditional political establishment, who set about planning to remove Chavez by any means necessary. And so their first attempt for that came in 2002 and was initiated via a kind of unprecedented campaign of economic sabotage against the Chavez government, partly orchestrated by the right-wing kind of yellow union Venezuelan union bureaucracy in cahoots with the country's richest capitalists. Most notably, white-collar workers and managers in the state oil company, the PDVSA, committed serious acts of sabotage, even kind of bombs and that kind of thing, against the to basically paralyze the whole oil industry and bring the entire economy to a halt. And so it was in this context of this intense economic war that cabal of capitalists, politicians, church officials and generals arrested Chavez, essentially kidnapped him, and proclaimed the establishment of a new government at the presidential palace. The head of Venezuela's Chamber of Commerce, Pedro Carmona, declared himself president of Venezuela and dissolved the National Assembly, the parliament, and the Supreme Court to the uproarious applause of Venezuela's rich and powerful. It's actually quite a really good documentary called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. That basically captures all this on camera, and you can kind of in this documentary you can kind of just see the elation of the Venezuelan elites as they basically just dissolve any try to set up a dictatorship. And so the Venezuelan working class rose to meet the challenge. Hundreds of thousands of people poured onto the streets of Caracas, many from the impoverished working class neighborhoods in the hills surrounding the city. They descended in huge numbers to the presidential palace, surrounding the building and demanding the return of Chavez. And so, swayed by the uprising that was taking place outside the gates of the palace, the presidential guard sided with Chavez and decided to switch to the other side and retook the presidential palace, dispersing the coup government and effectively restoring control of the country to the Chavistas. Elsewhere, later that year, workers actively defended oil installations against sabotage in an effort to stop the free fall of the economy. And so, through that, early in 2003, members of the corrupt and bloated union bureaucracy in control of the state oil company, who had sabotaged production and kind of caused this whole economic crisis, were fired en masse. And so, with his right-wing opponents fleeing to the US and Canada, US and Colombia, sorry, and the economy back on track, Chavez was in control and more popular than ever. It was clear that the right-wing opposition had been routed and would remain in a position of political weakness for almost a decade. It is in the years following this coup attempt that with Chavez more or less securely in power and at a high kind of point of his popularity, that Chavismo and the Bolivarian process, as it can be called, reached the height of its political influence and radicalism. So emboldened by his victory in the coup, Chavez made a rhetorical turn to the left. He became more antagonistic towards the United States and its economic interests in Latin America, and vocally opposed the Iraq War. So one example of this is at one point, right after Bush had spoken at the General Assembly of the UN, Chavez got up and kind of sniffed the air and said, "Oh, it smells of sulfur. The devil has been here." domestically, politics turned sharply to the left. The Bolivarian circles, small groups of local left-wing activists supportive of Chavez began to proliferate and grow, forming the backbone of a mass movement which propelled forward Chavez's reform agenda. Even questions of workers' power and control over production were raised in this period. Workers at several factories abandoned by capitalists in the period of economic chaos took them into their own control, forming cooperatives with the backing of the government. The state oil company, the PDVSA, was for a time home to a workers' assembly that produced its own paper and staffed its own workers' militia and was effectively controlling production. And so while many of these enterprises were later subsumed under state management, and I'll go more into the problems of that later, that workers were trying to do this at all and were like occupying industries and trying to take control of production was a sign of the times and kind of unprecedented in terms of the pink tide, you know, in every country except for Argentina, there were some examples of that. This is also the period that Chavez's most ambitious and far-reaching social programs were implemented. Called the Misiones, these programs were aimed at Chavez's social base amongst the Venezuelan working class. They included massive spending programs on healthcare, education, and indigenous services, funded through Venezuela's state oil company. These programs saw a very significant reduction in illiteracy and poverty. Importantly, these programs existed independently of the established state bureaucracies, many of which were filled with officials who were deeply hostile towards Chavez and his plans for the country. And so this is kind of the high point of Chavismo. However, even at this high point, I think you can see some of the weaknesses inherent to the politics and the whole Bolivarian process. The independence of the new Chavista social programs from the old state bureaucracy, while giving Chavez more flexibility, created a new bureaucratic class that ended up being just as corrupt and entrenched as the old, and loyal to Chavez only as a patron. It is these functionaries that would rise up to key positions of power in government and state-managed industries. Some would even join the ranks of what came to be called as the boliburguesia, the bourgeoisie, a section of Venezuelan oligarchs who grew rich during the Chavistas' time in power. This new class of politicians, bureaucrats, capitalists, and military men would later come to dominate the Venezuelan government under Maduro. Similarly, it is easy to see now that Chavez did not fundamentally while he was in power, did not fundamentally restructure the economy in any serious way that could have warded off the current economic situation that faces the country. Public expenditure on economic growth remained low throughout the entire period, and of the money that was actually invested into the economy, significant portions of it were lost to corruption. So in one case, George Giordani, government minister for planning, announced that as much as 40% of the funds allocated to his portfolio in 2013, so the guy who's meant to be, you know, kind of fueling economic growth in the country, 40% of those funds had gone to phantom companies created to launder money for Venezuelan capitalists and bureaucrats. And so this amounted to more than $190 billion that, through corruption, essentially vanished into thin air, never to return to Venezuela after some kind of, you know, offshore bank account. And so while sanctions and by the United States and various forms of economic sabotage, particularly the hoarding of goods by capitalists, which has always kind of been a tool of the Latin American bourgeoisies to hoard goods and then blame it on the government. While that economic sabotage has definitely played a negative economic role throughout the entire period that Chavistas have been in power, much of the blame for the state of the economic system can and should be placed at the inefficiency and corruption of the new state bureaucracy. I think more importantly than that, Chavez totally failed to challenge Venezuela's economic dependence on oil. So while the oil economy has always been a source of wealth for Venezuela's capitalists, in all other terms, it has been nothing but a catastrophe for the country. Geared more for the export of oil to the United States than the needs of Venezuelan people, or even those of kind of basic national economic development, the focus on oil production means that the economy is always subject to fluctuations in the price of oil. And so it's partly due to the huge collapse in the price of oil in 2014, 15, and 16 that has set off the current kind of deep economic crisis that is going on under Maduro. And to give you a sense of just how bad the kind of structuring of the economy is in this way, this monoculture of oil, Venezuela imports up to 80% of its food. Whereas previously, it was before the discovery of oil in Venezuela, it was a major agricultural exporter. And so a big factor of this is that all of Chavez's social programs also depended on oil revenue, which meant that the survival of any of these programs that were inaugurated by Chavez depended on the continuing health of the industry. And so when the industry collapsed, it essentially meant that the programs immediately kind of began to disintegrate and not have any of the funds necessary to do the basic day-to-day things that they were meant to do. And so I think out of this period, we also see two important dynamics in the politics of Chavismo play out, namely a debilitating emphasis on Chavez as an individual and a kind of personality, and a kind of a reformist outlook in regards to social change. And these two dynamics supported and informed each other. The focus on the state and substituting state action for workers' self-activity stemmed from Chavez's personality and his position as president, and vice versa. And so in practice, this meant that while Chavez clearly saw mass participation and kind of support on the street as central to the success of his political program, and kind of talked quite often about the grassroots of the Chavista movement, this mass participation was overwhelmingly centered around the electoral sphere, and often quite passive. And so while on the ground, many working class supporters of Chavismo went far beyond this, and you can kind of see this with some of the things that happened with the communal councils, which were meant to kind of be these kind of organizations of direct democracy. And you kind of saw serious development of working class kind of self-organization and activity. Most of these developments were confined by their attachment to the state apparatus and to the political and social forces tied to Chavez. So with the example of the communes, while they embody this kind of sense of direct democracy, in practice, they don't go beyond the scope of, say, a local council would in Australia, as in they deal with local issues, but aren't willing to take up issues of national leadership or contradict the government. And so the role played by the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the PSUV, is emblematic of this. And so the PSUV was formed in 2006 by Chavez as part of his kind of turn to the left. And it was posed as a kind of new mass socialist party that would include the various left forces backing Chavez and cohere the mass movement around him. And so when it was formed, 6 million people flocked to join the party within weeks. And that's huge for Venezuela. And would essentially, if in international terms, it would make it the largest kind of mass party in the world. And so the Venezuelan revolutionary left at the time entered kind of very contentious debates around whether to maintain a degree of separation from the new party or enter it themselves. And so you clearly got a sense that you would either be inside the PSUV and kind of have to deal with all the implications of that in terms of loyalty to the government, or just be completely irrelevant. And it's important here to emphasise that the way that the party was formed kind of impacts a bunch of the stuff I'm going to talk about later in terms of the internal politics, in that it wasn't formed through some kind of development of the mass movement. It was formed by directive from Chavez. And so Chavez said, we're going to have a party. And then there was a kind of very small number of people who then formulated the kind of structure of the party without any kind of input from the masses. And so while the party maintained a certain degree of formal democracy, it was essentially run by directive from Chavez himself, with little input or say from the membership. And this practice kind of suffocated any idea of mass participation and crystallized the PSUV into an undemocratic, crystallized party. And by the time Maduro became president, many of the more openly critical left-wing groupings within the PSOV had been had kind of left, realizing that there wasn't much space for an actual argument to be made inside the party, or had been actively driven out, as was the case with Marea Socialista, which is kind of, one of the larger, not in relative terms it's not very large, but one of the larger kind of groups to the left of Chavismo. And so to give a sense of the way that this kind of dislocation between the membership and the leadership in 2008, only 2 years after the party had been formed, at the elections of that year, only 2 million out of the 6 million members of the party actually turned out to vote. And so I think, as all of the things I've just talked about illustrate, the Chavez years laid the groundwork for the disastrous presidency of his successor, Nicolás Maduro, the weaknesses of his presidency. And so, elected in 2013, after Chavez's death by cancer, Maduro's only real strength was his ability to make out that he represented a continuity in Chavismo, and so he was continuing his legacy, though quite unconvincingly, I think. And so the goodwill that was generated by this association with Maduro kind of rapidly evaporated as the economy worsened due to collapsing oil prices, corruption, and a mounting economic offensive from the Venezuelan capitalist class, which had just kind of started to regain its political confidence since the 2002 coup. And so, responding to the economic crisis, Maduro's position has been one of austerity and an abandonance of any pretense of his government representing the economic interests of the Venezuelan working class and poor. So rather than challenging multinational corporations, Maduro has courted them openly. In 2013, during his first year in office, one-third of the national budget was devoted to credit given to private firms, many of them international conglomerates like Nestlé or Chevron. Most notorious amongst his overtures to business, and this is kind of more recent, has been the Arco Minero project. And essentially, this is a plan to open up 12% of the entire surface and all the land below it, 12% of all the land in Venezuela, to international mining consortiums, threatening massive environmental devastation. This is in the Amazonian section of Venezuela, and the confiscation of kind of mass destruction of indigenous land in Venezuela. And so, in response to hostility to this proposal from the left, Maduro has chosen to deploy repression, particularly directed at the indigenous community and kind of left-wing activists who are opposed to this. And more recently, a few weeks before the coup, Maduro has taken steps to water down labor agreements and kind of implement wage restrictions, as well as privatizing some of the kind of the services that had previously been established by Chavez. And none of this has kind of done anything to halt the economic crisis and the kind of immense suffering that is genuinely going on amongst the Venezuelan working class right now. And so instead, this kind of political crisis has exploded in, this economic crisis has now exploded into a political crisis. And that had kind of, the beginning of that is in the 2015 parliamentary election, where off the back of an extremely low turnout of government supporters, the PSOV basically lost those elections to the right. And you can kind of, the factors behind that are myriad, but I think you can look to deep unpopularity of Maduro as a kind of personality as compared to Chavez, and kind of increasing hyperinflation and the cost of living. And so electorally, this victory for the right was not a result of kind of working class supporters defecting kind of to the right, but of working class Venezuelans not turning out to vote for the Chavistas as they had consistently done for the previous decade and a half. And so with both Maduro unwilling to mobilize the traditional working class base of Chavismo by kind of addressing the genuine economic grievances that people have, and the right-wing opposition, on the other hand, totally hostile to any measures whatsoever to deal with a crisis that is partly of their own making through the sabotage and their kind of initiation of the political crisis, you've seen a kind of total disillusionment of Venezuelan workers, and a removal of them, I would argue, from the political contest that is going on right now in Venezuela. And so I would argue that the political fight over the future of the country has become entirely dominated and centered in the bureaucratic maneuvering between the different government institutions controlled by either the PSOE or the MUD, which is the Democratic Roundtable, the right-wing opposition coalition. And any kind of action on the streets, the protests, I think are kind of used as are organized from the top down as kind of set piece shows of strength for either party, and they kind of don't really they don't embody the same kind of huge crowds which you saw around the 2002 coup or the kind of rallies in support of Maduro in support of Chavez. I mean, after that. And so this kind of dynamic of the bureaucratic and institutional war between the two factions has totally dominated the political situation since, and is the primary way that the coup earlier this year kind of played out. And part of this is also that with Maduro kind of increasingly distant from any working class base that Chavismo once held amongst the population, and kind of the power that that gave Chavismo, he's increasingly turned to the military hierarchy as his real base of support. The generals have become more and more dominant in the cabinet and the governorship of Venezuela's states. And so a majority of Venezuela's states now have governors from the military. And so while this is kind of partly a legacy of Chavez, in that he always kind of portrayed himself as close to the military and talked about this kind of idea of a military-civilian union, as he was kind of a military man and he had all these associations with them. And he kind of conceptualized a patriotic military that would serve the Venezuelan people. This kind of concept has morphed into a total dominance of a very small clique of nepotistic generals over the kind of high executive mechanisms of government. Likewise, I think it's important to point out that Maduro has made a mockery of the democratic institutions previously championed by the Chavistas. In 2016, as part of the right-wing street protests taking place in cities across the country, the opposition raised the question of a recall referendum to remove Maduro from power. And they were effectively trying to use the more democratic measures put into the 1999 constitution by the Chavistas against them. Rather than rising to the challenge and kind of facing the recall referendum head-on, as Chavez had done in 2004 successfully, the government essentially used the courts to get the National Electoral Commission to cancel the referendum. I think this kind of turn to the right and towards more bureaucratic, like the bureaucratic war, is also seen in Maduro's attempts to convene his own constituent assembly in 2017. And I think it's worth going into this in detail because I think a lot of people on the international left had this kind of conception that the Constituent Assembly would be some kind of progressive move, that it would reinvigorate the Bolivarian process. I think it's done the opposite, and it's worth going into. So while in 1999, Chavez's Constituent Assembly in 1999 had been massively supported, broadly democratic, and involved open public debate involving all sectors of the left and sizable sectors of the population. You saw kind of mass debates in the streets around that constituent assembly. Maduro's constituent assembly has been a kind of pale shadow of that. And so attempting to outmaneuver the National Assembly, which is now controlled by the right, Maduro instigated the constituent assembly by presidential decree. And so unlike in 1999, the question of the convocation of the constituent assembly was not put to a referendum. So Venezuelans had no say in whether this body should be convened. And polling basically suggested that it was broadly unpopular, even amongst traditional supporters of Chavismo. Likewise, the elections to the Constituent Assembly were not accompanied by open public debate, but by disengaged apathy from workers and open hostility by the middle and upper class, who boycotted the election entirely. And so as a result of that, the election itself basically served only to rubber stamp the appointment of prominent PSOE officials. And this even included Maduro's own son. So Maduro's own son was elected to this body. And elections. So while the traditional Chavista base did not really turn out to vote, they did actually vote in this election. It was more kind of, I think I would argue it's more a show of kind of passive support and not really any kind of participation in or endorsement of what Maduro was doing. As in, in this bureaucratic battle, they were still willing to kind of rubber stamp what the government was doing. And so, as I was talking about before, far from reinvigorating the Bolivarian process, as some of the international left had hoped, the Constituent Assembly was used by the government as another tool in its bureaucratic and institutional war with the opposition. Convened days after the election, the Constituent Assembly set about stripping legislative power from the National Assembly. And this effectively created a kind of parallel parliamentary structure in the country. And so Venezuela now has two competing parliaments, the National Assembly controlled by the right and the Constituent Assembly controlled by Maduro. And they both kind of claim legitimacy over the country. They also moved to bar several opposition parties from participating in the 2018 election. And this all but assured that election would be boycotted by the opposition. And so this boycotting essentially meant that the only candidate who kind of ran against Maduro in any serious capacity was Henry Falcon, and he kind of didn't really stand much of a chance of winning. And so, in effect, this essentially just added to the opposition's arguments that they were being repressed and that that there's like no option for them other than a violent military coup. And so this kind of intensification of the bureaucratic war has led to a reassessment of strategy amongst the right-wing opposition. Since they were put into a position of kind of definite weakness after the failure of the coup in 2002, the right have been forced to limit themselves to largely constitutional and legitimate means to remove Chavez. And so this played out largely in the area of kind of electoral politics and the failed 2004 recall referendum, which I talked about before. However, when the economic crisis kind of really started to heat up in 2013, the political space was opened up to pursue a more aggressive strategy. They now began organising open street protests, quite large ones, mainly organising right-wing students, and they kind of tried to galvanise a disillusioned and kind of angry Venezuelan middle class. And so this is what kind of helped catapult them into a position of control of the National Assembly in 2015. And so since then, while they managed to take control of the National Assembly and they thought that this would be some massive victory that would then mean that they could impeach Maduro, it's actually meant the opposite. And they failed totally in their efforts to dislodge him. And so now I think they've had a reassessment of strategy and they've turned back towards a coup, in kind of violent methods. And this is kind of the situation where Guaido enters the picture, and the whole coup process begins. And so, on one level, it's not entirely clear how they thought Guaido declaring himself president would result in getting rid of Maduro and the Chavistas. One option is that they envisioned that international pressure brought to bear against Maduro, particularly by the United States and kind of neighbouring Brazil and Colombia, both controlled by right-wing governments, would result in his kind of resignation or the calling of a new presidential election. And so this strategy has actually worked quite well for the Latin American right in the past and was the mechanism by which the Sandinistas were thrown out of power for the first time in Nicaragua back in the in 1990. But now this option kind of seems off the cards. And even if Maduro were to step down, that would not give them the decisive political victory that I think they're aiming for. Maduro is one of only thousands of pesos government officials that are ingrained into state institutions and whose interests are kind of directly at odds with the opposition. And so while it's possible that you can envision some kind of accord between the new state bureaucracies created by Chavez and Maduro with the right in the event of a political defeat, Maduro being thrown out or something of the sort, it doesn't seem like the right is keen on any kind of compromise. And And it's easy to see why, because if they ever did kind of take over the executive mechanism of government, if they took over the presidency, they wouldn't really have control over the country outside the presidential palace. There'd still be all these thousands of government officials who are Chavista government officials who are ingrained into all these institutions. And so what has become kind of increasingly clear out of that is that Guaido and the right kind of see a coup as a stepping stone to a more violent confrontation with the Maduro government. And so the declaration is itself kind of the first step in a play towards getting the military to overthrow Maduro or initiating some kind of violent civil war. And so it's important to kind of go into the role of the military and what they're kind of aiming for here, because their denouncements of Maduro as a dictator have always kind of been accompanied with calls for the military, particularly the high hierarchy, to kind of switch sides and legitimize Guaido and the opposition with military force. Yeah. So while they have kind of very little power outside of the National Assembly, like in actual real terms, besides kind of the sections of capital that support them, the military is this kind of one force that they see as kind of contested, that they might be able to get the generals on side. And so this kind of all really came to the fore with the foreign aid stunt they orchestrated at the Colombian border. And so this was basically this effort organized in conjunction with international aid agencies, the Colombian government, the American government, and like a bunch of like right-wing celebrities. Quite bizarre, really. They had like a concert, a bunch of right-wing kind of musicians at it. And so this stunt was essentially meant to kind of organize a caravan of aid, which was meant to go into Venezuela and kind of save the poor, starving people in Venezuela. And while there is kind of real economic hardship in Venezuela, that could easily be addressed by just lifting the sanctions. What this was about was just about essentially using this idea of aid as a kind of hammer to smash the government and basically force forced defections from the military. And so the aid itself was offered to Guaido as the legitimate president and essentially was saying, well, if you want the aid, then you basically have to you basically have to defect and join the other side. And the presence of kind of a bunch of kind of quite vile American officials, particularly Elliot Abrams, who I'll go into detail in a little bit, because his presence kind of signals what the US kind of intended with all this. His presence kind of makes it clear that that the pressure for elements of the military to defect was also like coming from directly from Washington. It's also worth saying that Sebastián Piñera was there, the president of Chile, this kind of vile neoliberal Chilean president. So it's a kind of regional alliance of right wing forces who are trying to kind of organize this. Ultimately, though, the stunt kind of failed spectacularly. The expected defection of a section of the Venezuelan military never materialized. There were a few like bizarre incidents involving gunfire across the border and stuff like that. They're quite unclear, but nothing kind of materialized out of this. And it seems that Maduro's kind of closeness with the military and the high command has shielded him against the worst pressures from the United States and the internal opposition. And so while for now this element has kind of prevented his defeat, Maduro's dependence and closeness on the military is also a key kind of political weakness that I want to go into a bit more. So while he's always presented the closeness with the military as some kind of huge strength of his government and taken every opportunity to propagandize surrounded by the troops, this has left him exposed should the generals decide to switch sides. Yeah, so while for us this is a question of political principle, you wouldn't invite the generals into the cabinet, it's also not particularly smart for him. So you think of perhaps like the government of Salvador Allende in Chile, and that Allende similarly blustered and talked nonsense about the patriotic and civic loyalty of the military, maintaining even on the day of the 1973 coup, as La Moneda, the presidential palace in Chile, was surrounded by troops from the military, that future dictator Augusto Pinochet was on his side and had been arrested. You know, so there's illusions about the military that I think need to be challenged. Even though, while for now Maduro seems to still have them on side, though that may not stay the same in the future. Okay. Okay. So I think it's also worth going into kind of the role of the US kind of quickly, because I think it's an important element that needs to be discussed. The Trump administration, for its part, has announced the full backing of Guaido, which culminates kind of 2 decades of bipartisan hostility towards Venezuela from the White House. Democrats and Republicans both have always been hostile towards Chavez and Venezuela, seeing a kind of defiant nationalist regime there, more or less hostile to U.S. business interests, as kind of a barrier to its imperial hegemony in its own backyard. I think there is, though, an important difference between the open hostility that Trump displays towards Venezuela now and kind of the low-level hostility that Obama displayed, and I'll go into that a bit now. So it's not an exaggeration, I think, to say that US military intervention, or at least the threat of it, is on the cards. So John Bolton, the National Security Advisor to the Trump administration, has said that all options are on the table in regards to Venezuela. At a recent press conference around the time of the coup, he made what you can either consider an open threat or a total blunder by holding up a notepad while he was doing the press conference, which had 5,000 troops to Colombia written on it in full sight of cameras. Then you have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who has gone completely off the deep end, claiming that Hezbollah has active cells in Venezuela and that Iran, this is a quote, Iran has influence there and throughout South America. Trump himself has been as belligerent as ever on Twitter, telling Americans not to travel to Venezuela and that the United States is ready to help Guaido fight to restore Venezuelan democracy. Yeah. And part of this is also a report that came out last year from the Associated Press claiming that Trump had repeatedly raised the question of invading Venezuela to his national security team, only to be talked down. Mike Pence has been even more belligerent than Trump. He's spoken at a number of rallies of Cuban and Venezuelan expatriates in Miami, and this is a quote from him. This is no time for dialogue. It's time to end the Maduro regime. And so for those who were kind of around during the lead-up to the Iraq War, it's not so dissimilar, you know, the way that they're talking about. An important part of this is also the appointment of Elliot Abrams as a kind of special envoy to Venezuela. For those who haven't heard of him, Elliot Abrams has a long and illustrious career in support of U.S. imperialism in Latin America and its kind of most barbarous episodes. And that he would be the kind of person that they have on point on this is kind of indicative of their general plan. So Abrams cut his teeth working for the Reagan administration in Central America, where in 1981 he helped cover up the massacre of 500 civilians by a right-wing death squad in El Salvador, the El Masote massacre. He was also one of the main U.S. government officials who helped funnel money to the Contras, who were U.S. Right-wing, U.S.-backed terrorists who killed tens of thousands of people in Nicaragua back in the 1980s. And he similarly did this through international aid shipments. So, you know, like the fact that they were trying to get international supposed international aid into Venezuela should be indicative of something. Yeah. There also seems to be no faction kind of currently within the White House anymore that is not supportive of this new hawkish stance towards Venezuela. John Kelly, the chief of staff, who was meant to keep a leash on Trump around foreign affairs and international relations, supposedly, according to the liberal press, has resigned from his position earlier this year after falling out with Trump. H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor who allegedly talked Trump out of pursuing a military option in Venezuela, has also been pushed out. Rex Tillerson, allegedly another vocal opponent of intervention in Venezuela, has also been pushed out from his position as Secretary of State. So everyone who's said, maybe we shouldn't invade this country, has essentially not in the White House anymore. Meanwhile, in Congress, I think it's worth emphasizing just how bad the Democrats are on this too. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, has come out in support of the coup, calling Venezuela's National Assembly the sole remaining democratic institution in the country. Then you have Marco Rubio, who is one of the most prominent House Republicans currently. He's openly urged the Venezuelan military to step in and depose Maduro in a military coup. And on Twitter, he said that General Suterno Maduro now will be spared from the purge of the armed forces that will follow the coup. And so he was actually at the Colombian border and kind of also helping kind of orchestrate this whole thing. That's quite galling. It's also worth kind of, just to finish up, it's also worth briefly touching on the importance of all this in relation to the rest of Latin America and the Pink Tide. Venezuela, accurately or not, is seen as the one remaining roadblock to this whole resurgence of the Latin American right that we've seen in Brazil, in Argentina, with Macri, Piñera in Chile. And so a victory for the right in Venezuela is important for the neoliberal kind of post-Pink Tide regional order that they want to kind of construct. If they manage to kind of smash the Venezuelan regime, that's just an ideological victory for them. So it's worth keeping in mind. So while the future is unclear in terms of what it will bring for Venezuela, there are a few scenarios I would argue that have a good outcome at all for the Venezuelan working class and left. The working class is demoralized, politically disarmed, and shackled by a corrupt political leadership that's hopelessly entangled in a nightmare of its own making. I think what should be clear to all of us, both the left in Venezuela and internationally, is that we have to stand firm against the threat of a serious kind of imperialist venture into the country. But also, at the same time, present an honest and fair accounting of what went wrong and of the total bankruptcy and betrayal of the working class by the leaders of the PSUV. And I think only then can we really hope to prevent another tragedy like the one that is unfolding now in Venezuela, and arm ourselves politically for the inevitable and forceful return of Venezuelan workers into mass struggle, as they did so spectacularly in 2002 and in kind of the highest and best years of Chavismo.